Hello and welcome to Dial If for Flanger. And I should explain that I am Flanger and Dial If for Flanger is the name of the podcast where I can talk about whatever I want to do with comics and stuff. And today I am talking about the finale of JL Ape Guerrilla Warfare as part of JL April. And we are talking about Martian Manhunter Annual number 2 from 1999, which means I probably have the guy who's into the Martian Manhunter on the podcast. And let me check. Yes, I do. I have Diablo Frank on the podcast.
It's kind of my thing.
It is your thing. Yeah, this is the final chapter of this annual event. So not all the podcasts have been doing the JL Ape stories. And in fact, the only there's only been 4 chapters of this covered, if you include this one. I did the JLA one, which started it, and the Aquaman one, which was part 5, and this concluding one, which is part 8. And Bill on the Batpod did the Batman Annual number 23, which was the Batman chapter. It's sort of a Nightwing chapter more than anything. But anyway, so that's what your coverage is. So if you're looking around for the, Wonder Woman or Green Lantern or Flash, no one's covered them. And Superman. So yeah, and I don't remember those chapters being fantastic, but there is a really brief summary of what happens in all them, and it's in the middle of this comic. It's a little bit of exposition where Batman and the Martian Manhunter stand opposite each other and explain things. So that's, do you know the page I mean, Frank?
Oh, I know exactly what you're talking about, because I was like, hey, this is exactly what I wanted. I wanted you guys to tell me what happened the rest of these chapters, because I dreaded going in and trying to read any of those. I did buy the Wonder Woman when it came out. I did read it the one time. I don't recall liking that one very much either. Not in a huge hurry to reread it, although I probably will before the month's out. But it's good to know the key points so that I can skim it. If it starts to really suck, I'll just skim the thing and get that out of the way.
Yeah. All right. So we'll give everyone a little bit of a synopsis based on what Batman and Martian Manhunter are saying to each other as a excuse to say it to the reader. So, to review, Solovar, leader of the Gorilla City, announces his intentions to open relations with humanity and for Gorilla City to join the United Nations. Solovar is assassinated by a terrorist group of human supremacists, later revealed to be a front for the extremist political faction known as Simeon Scarlet. Gorilla City asks the JLA to act as diplomatic intermediaries, who are ambushed and transformed into gorillas by exotic technology. The chain shifts JLA members' loyalties to Gorilla City until you the Martian Manhunter, telepathically restore their original thought patterns. Prince Regent Ulgo declares war on humanity with the intention of transforming all humans into gorillas. Subsequently, a covert gorilla agent known as Grimm forms an alliance with the organized crime in Bloodhaven for the purpose of smuggling weapons and troops into the United States. Meanwhile, Atlantis is attacked by the gorilla sub, the Kong, under Admiral Trafalgo, in an attempt to steal a mystic crystal called the Eye of Poseidon to power the morphic resonance array. Led by Simeon sorceress Abugita, this is Martian Manhunter talking now, I can't do it with his voice. Led by Simeon sorceress Abugita, apes invade the Amazon city as Themyscira. In Central City, the Flash, Max Mercury, and Impulse are enslaved by the longtime outlaw called Gorilla Grodd to change his Speed Force reactor, providing the morphic resonance array with a power source to substitute for the Eye of Poseidon. In Washington, the smuggled components of the gorilla-built war machine dubbed Grogamesh are assembled. Piloted by Ulgo, Grogamesh kidnaps the Daily Planet reporter Lois Lane and is defeated by Superman. However, by this time, the orbital morphic resonator array is operational, defended by a force of space marines led by General Zolog, aided by Green Lantern, who has been subverted to the guerrilla cause. Thanks to my rather duplicitous efforts, Green Lantern was restored to normal, as have been the rest of the JLA. The morphic resonance array was destroyed, but not before a significant portion of the world's population had been transformed into gorillas. Chaos currently reigns. Yeah, so that's what you've missed in the event. And DC have put out a trade paperback of it, which is very well timed. It came out this month. And just this very week, they dropped it on DC Universe Infinite Ultra. So if you're an Ultra subscriber, you can go read the whole thing or flip through it or just get pictures for your podcast, which I'm going to do in a minute. Anyway, so Frank, let's talk about the Martian Manhunter Annual. Now, this came out during or part of John Ostrander's run on Martian Manhunter.
Yes, that is correct. This was roughly a year in because they had the stunt scheduling in the early part of the run, where they did a zero issue, an annual, a 1 million issue. So we're pretty well past the 1 year point, but it came out the same month as issue 11.
And yeah, that was a very sort of moody and kind of serious run of Martian Manhunter, which is this book is kind of tonally not similar to.
Yeah, and for me, honestly, it was a welcome change of pace. I was really looking forward to the Ostrander Mandrake series. I was a big fan of the work on Grimjack, and Ostrander in general was one of my favorite comic book writers. And I just never took to his approach to the Martian Manhunter. And over the course of reading that book for 3 years, I just became more and more critical, and it got under my skin more and more. So for this book to come out and for it to have a little bit more of that JLI Manhunter vibe, even though it's not really a funny book, but it's still a light, fun book. And given my druthers, I'd rather had a book like this as opposed to the one I was getting.
Yeah. So yeah, this was not by the regular team, though. It's Len Kaminski, who did the first chapter of JLA. And we have pencils by Gus Vasquez and inks by Mark Probst and Claude St. Aubin. And letters by Kirk Hathaway, colors by Carla Feeney. Separator was Jamison. I had a separator. Whew. And Dan Raspler was the editor, and Tony Bedard, future writer, was the associate editor. So I have a brief synopsis here, which I'll read through, and then we can talk about what's in the issue itself, called Fear and Loathing on the Planet of the Apes. So during his first years on Earth, Martian Manhunter traveled to Africa and took on the form of a gorilla in order to live among them and gain greater insights on humans. Sometimes after being accepted by a group of gorillas, he saw an anthropology team studying the gorillas before poachers massacred both the gorillas and the anthropology team. When Martian Manhunter saw that what the poachers did, he transformed into his true form and used his powers to force them to turn themselves into the authorities. In the present, John Jones. Did you say John Jones or John Johns?
I actually go with the cartoon and go as John Jones now. But before that, I would have said John Jones.
I will defer to you. In the present, Jean Jones saw apes wreaking havoc on the streets and transformed into his true form, beginning going to the watchtower, where he and Batman briefed each other regarding the gorillas and their teammates who have been transformed into gorillas. Batman and Martian Manhunter both believe that they have their suspect in perpetrating the Gorilla City situation, and the Dark Knight gave the Martian a list of their suspects, known and probable associates, located outside Gorilla City. Then Batman held a JLA meeting with Zor-El, Plastic Man, and Aquaman being absent, as the Atlantean was in pursuit of the Kong, which opened fire on the USS Serling. When men at NORAD, who had been transformed into apes, learned of the Kong firing on the Serling, General Heston decided to fire up silos and make the world safe for ape democracy. In his human form, Martian Manhunter visited the third name on Batman's list, Bobo T. Chimpanzee, although he was of no help. At the Watchtower, the JLA saw that NORAD had launched missiles directly towards Gorilla City. Superman volunteered to stop the missiles and ordered the Flash, Wonder Woman, and Green Lantern to evacuate its inhabitants in case he failed to prevent the impact. While Batman and Steel searched for ways to revert the humans transformed into apes back to normal. Martian Manhunter visited Monsieur Mallard in Paris and questioned him about the suspect. Superman was attempting to intercept the missiles in space, while Martian Manhunter questioned the suspect's brother, Samuel Simeon, and the Flash. Wonder Woman and Green Lantern, with help from Grogamish, evacuated the inhabitants of Gorilla City. Martian Manhunter ended his search by questioning Congo Bill of the Forgotten Heroes, who provided him with the final piece of the puzzle. Superman used one missile to destroy the other two, as the Flash, Wonder Woman, and Green Lantern had finished evacuating the gorillas. Aquaman dragged the Kong from the ocean before he, Superman, and Martian Manhunter joined their teammates. Martian Manhunter revealed that Gorilla Grodd was the one responsible for the incident, causing the apes to argue amongst themselves before the suspect revealed himself and attacked the Martians. Grodd attempted to devolve Martian Manhunter, but was defeated. At the chambers of the Gorilla City Council, the apes praised the JLA, and Ulgo apologized to them and offered to pay reparations. Martian Manhunter suggested that Grogamesh could be sit with the JLA in the Hall of Justice one day. Later, Green Lantern worked with Batman and Steel to assemble a machine that would revert humans transformed into apes back to their normal selves. Martian Manhunter stared out at the Watchtower's window and believed that he would remain an outsider on the planet of the apes, regardless of which species ruled the Earth. Meanwhile, the gorillas took Grodd to Arbroath Asylum. Okay, Frank, so let's talk about the cover. So another Art Adams joint, and it looks great, doesn't it?
Oh, it's gorgeous. It's gorgeous. I mean, I'm a huge fan of Arthur Adams, have been since the day one long shot when that was coming out. He's particularly good at drawing Martian Manhunter, and he's particularly good at drawing gorillas. And of course, he's a great Gorilla Grodd artist. His art from the Who's Who loose leaf was used to make the DC Direct action figure, which I have, and I believe it was on one of my shelves over there. So yeah, I'm getting a bunch of favorites all together in one place on this cover. No complaints. And one thing I really like too is that Grodd, of course, has proper gorilla dimensions, but to other Martian Manhunter, he's actually somewhat svelte. He doesn't have the barrel chest. He's a little bit more ripped, but he still has the very simian head and more of a squat frame. And of course, he's got the foot hands and everything. So there's all these ways to make you know that yes, it is John Jones is a ape, but he's not with the apes either. He's not quite ape enough to pass for apes among apes. So nice little tell there.
Yeah, and there's a pile of jail apes piled up below them both as they struggle. I love the fine line on the cover. Like it looks like it was done such a massive scale and then zoomed straight down. It looks so fine, the details. It's terrific.
Yeah, I love that he has not missed a beat in all these years.
Yes, of course, we have the logo for the JLA Guerrilla Warfare, which says annual behind that, and there's eight bananas dangling from the L, so an extra banana for every chapter, and this is the final one. Well, yeah, let's get into it. What did you think of the first few pages?
I love that sequence. It was one of the things that turned me on to the book immediately. I always liked Lynn Kamensky. I always thought he was underrated. He's not an Alan Moore. He's never going to conquer the world or anything. But he just had a voice in comics that I appreciated and I grew to whenever he did a comic book. And I like when they explore things that Martian Manhunter did besides be a cop in Denver or Middletown, depending on what continuity you're going with. So having him live amongst the apes and how that he reacted to that, getting a little bit of a Gorillas of the Mist action in there as well. Yeah, I fully appreciated that. And I also like that Gus Vasquez has an expressive style. So, like when the poachers are coming in, there's a moment of horror and it's drawn broadly. So, you can almost see it, it's comedic, but obviously the subject matter won't allow for that. But he has interesting body postures with among the poachers. And definitely, when you see the Martian Manhunter find the dead apes, he himself is an ape and he has the red eyes and the fury. Yeah, I'm digging it.
To me, it struck me as this is fairly serious because I remember reading this and thinking, oh, this is quite a fun comic. That was my memory of it. So opening it, this opening three pages is quite a bummer because it's basically got some apes getting slaughtered. But I thought one thing it does do is emphasize John's outsiderness from humans and apes and everything. Like he is a stranger in a strange land. And I think that's often forgotten. He's just a bulky green Superman half the time.
Yeah, I always love it when they find the angle that's specific to the Martian Manhunter. Also, the book as a whole finds that sweet spot because finding that pathos among something that's as big and ridiculous as J.L. Ape is his lane. Like, humor, you can have fun with him meeting all the different ape-themed characters, but they've also got to give you that little moment where it's like, aw, that little sad bit, that Pixar thing where by the end you're happy, but you have to go through the bitterness to get to the sweet. That's very much Martian Manhunter's lane.
Yeah, and the splash page where he looks out in the city and there's just gorillas going nuts, it really does give you the sense of urban chaos that's taken over, like gorillas dancing and singing and cars getting wrecked and women being manhandled, and yeah, there's a whole lot going on.
Well, what I like too is obviously they're trying to bring in as much ape stuff as they can into the greater story arc. But I think this chapter really hits the Planet of the Apes element. And I'm a big fan of that franchise. So for it to be my favorite character's annual amongst these annuals, yeah, I'm home.
But yeah, he leaves and he transforms himself from he's a human. He's John Jones the cop at this point, and he transforms and he immediately turns into his ape form, which is of course with the morphic resonance. So he can overcome that, but it takes him a moment to remember to do so because it's basically made his default form gorilla. Yeah, but then he heads up to the watchtower, and I mean I know when people have a lot of exposition to do, there's different approaches, but I really admire Len Kaminsky's, just roll up his sleeves and, okay, let's do it all at once.
Well, it's a situation where I think to some extent he's the architect of this thing. I don't know that he necessarily came to the editors and said, "Hi, I want to do JLA." I think that maybe an editor told him that he was going to be the point man, but he does really embrace it, and I think he takes advantage. I was a little bit apprehensive about reading these annuals because, it's a book from a quarter century ago, double or triple size. I didn't actually count the pages, and I'm like, oh boy, how much of a slog is this going to be just from the raw verbiage? and all the Lynn Kaminsky written ones have multiple two-page splashes. It really it decompresses the story. You don't need a lot of compression for an ape story, a jail ape story. So I really appreciated, like, okay, we're just going to take two pages and we're going to lay it all out for people, and we're even going to redraw panels from other comic books. You're going to know exactly what happened up to this point. And again, if I like the Kaminsky chapters, I read the first one, I read the last one, I'm not losing anything because they've got me completely up to speed. I'm fully here for this.
And I really like Vasquez's depiction of Batman. It's very toyetic, and it's kind of, you know, extending the Howard Porter look, but it gives him a mask that seems to have skull pieces in it to shape the outside a little bit. And he's got pointy shoulders on the cape, which, you know, I think that's a really good look for the Batman.
I think that's this thing. Was it Breyfogle or was it Phil Jimenez that really started to go nuts with that in the late 90s?
Breyfogle did really, really ridiculously long capes, but, you know, sort of Thor effect, not like Todd McFarlane. But yeah, it probably was Jimenez who did, you know, the really sculptured fins on the gloves and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, and the art by Vasquez, it's in that awkward place where you can see the strong manga elements coming into comics, but they're still trying to hold a line of that Bronze Age style. And I'm not sure the marriage 100% works. Like, you don't feel like this is a guy who's 100% ready for the mainstream, but in the context of a JLA annual, and especially in the context of a Martian Manhunter annual, I really like that kind of smoothness he has, that sort of little bit of rubberiness. I think that works really well for that character. And, you know, it suits Batman as well because it kind of leans into the whole vinyl bondage thing he's got going on. So I'm really appreciating the artwork. I don't know that I'd want to see it on a monthly basis, but I think it works really well for this material, and I'm really enjoying it in this context.
Yeah, but... I'm really perplexed by this ongoing thing of making it a mystery who's behind it. Like, you know, it's guerrilla crimes in the DC universe. Who's going to be behind it? You know, there's a list of suspects and it's got one name on it, but, you know, they keep pretending it's a mystery.
There's a little scene, a Tom Selleck movie from the 80s called My Alibi, where he plays a mystery writer who falls in love with a suspected murderess. And over the course of it, he's talking with his agent who tells him that people like his mystery novels because they can figure out who the killer is, because it's not that they're bad, but they're just predictable, and people find comfort in the predictability of that. So yeah, you're right. If you've got a mystery taking place in Vatveria, the first person you're going to think of is Dr. Doom. If it's not Dr. Doom, oh, is it Christoph impersonating Dr. Doom? Okay. Is it a Doombot? Is it Victor LaMancha? Like, the list gets more and more extraneous the further down you go. You pretty much know it's going to be a Doom or it's going to be a bad story. So yeah, obviously it's Grodd or bust. But I don't think that they're trying. Like, it's funny, they don't sell the mystery that hard. They sell it hard enough to where you feel like maybe they're making an effort, but obviously there's no effort to be made here. So I think it's just sort of like leaning into the obviousness and comforting the reader who already knows exactly who's going to be at the end of the story.
Yeah. And then we have a bit of business with the Kong submarine is now attacking an American submarine to show that, you know, Admiral Trafalgar is still out there. This is just a little bit of, you know, all this escalation and, you know, the stakes are getting higher and real world situation with nukes entering the skies to solve it all. And it's interesting that the American general, he's a gorilla, but he's still an American gorilla. So,
well, you've got to lean into the tribalism. It works for this material. Again, if they're trying to recall Planet of the Apes, you always had the chimpanzees versus the gorillas versus the orangutans and so forth. So it's just part of the package.
Yeah, but John is on his tour to get more clues, which is completely unnecessary, really. But it does give him the way to defeat the mystery villain of this. So his first stop is Bobo T. Chimpanzee, obviously much bigger thing now than he was back then as Detective Chimp. So basically, he is literally just doing detective agency stuff. But he's got a very nice office, and John observes that it's much nicer than his. And, you know, Bobo says it's because he does property investments, so which speaks of his canniness, I guess.
It's funny, JLA, a bunch of podcasts are participating in this. One of them is Shag over at Once Upon a Geek, and he did a spotlight on the Book of Fate crossover that involved Bobo after he'd already been revived as part of the Shadow Pact. Yeah. And he was talking about, well, how did you get introduced to this character? And it's funny because I'm a big official handbook of the Marvel Universe guy. I bought almost every issue of that book new since the last issue of the first volume. And as much as I love Who's Who in the DC Universe, I did not buy any of those Who's Who comic books throughout the runs, all the runs. They were all back issues for me, with the exception of the D's. And Detective Chimp was in that one volume. So that's how I was introduced to that character. And I had very little exposure to Bobo between the Who's Who and this annual, but I do have to give credit that they were doing Bobo before he was cool in the Marshmallow annual.
Yeah, it's a character who, I honestly think James Gunn is going to do something with Bobo sooner or later. The lure of a talking chimpanzee is just too good for the DC universe. And James Gunn seems to have the attitude of, I want to use the weird stuff in the DC universe, not just the cool stuff like Doomsday, like Zack Snyder wants to use.
James Gunn has predilections, and I think Bobo leans into those.
There's characters I predict he will use are Bobo and the Demon, for sure.
Oh, man, I got to see the Demon. I'm looking forward to that, because that's something that I don't think Marvel can quite pull off. I think that one of the ways in which DC can really assert itself is through the supernatural elements. Marvel has that, but they always have to superhero it up a lot, where DC can really get fantastical and do things that are, again, like a Bobo. But with Etrigan, I'm really looking forward to seeing what they end up doing with that character when that character inevitably shows up. And if he doesn't show up, then they're fools, because they're leaving money on the table there.
Absolutely. Yeah. So yeah, Superman is going off to stop the nukes, and the rest of the JLA are running off to do other things. But Martian Manhunter is now in Paris, and he's visiting Monsieur Mellor. And we actually, Monsieur Mellor is, you know, he's the team up with the Brain. He's the gorilla with the beret who's revolutionary, revealed to be the lover of the Brain, or would-be lover of the Brain. And they were sort of done in a joke issue of Doom Patrol, which ended with them both getting destroyed. This issue basically refutes that and says, no, he survived. They both survived. It's okay. So, yeah, what do you think of Monsieur Mellor?
I mean, I think the character is cool, but I don't have a ton of exposure to Doom Patrol. I know I'm on the wrong podcast to be confessing that. The vast majority of my exposure to Doom Patrol was from the Keith Giffen, Matthew Ryan. No, not Matthew Ryan. Matthew Clark series.
Yeah.
So that means not a lot of Mandra Mala. And the thing that gets me about that, too, is I really never thought that much about his politics. And I do have to wonder, and I'm certainly asking the right person, like, isn't being like a liberal extremist a thing that's really part of the comic books, or is this something they're playing with in this particular vignette?
Yeah, no, he's much of a, he's a philosopher, but, you know, very much the revolutionary type. So yeah, Grant Morrison definitely played with that. And Rick Veitch's Swamp Thing annual, which has Mellor in it, is very much the revolutionary, the philosopher attitude. But it's interesting because Mellor and the Brain, they both get used heaps outside of Doom Patrol. Like they really are fun villains that everyone wants to play with. So they have so many appearances outside of Doom Patrol. And pretty much every year there'll be two or three new short stories with them in them. So, yeah, they're obviously a real hit as well.
Well, it seems like Mancho Mala really leans into comedy. You know, it's hard to play him straight. Have they ever done a Doom Patrol volume where they play up the comedy? I know that, you know, Morrison went weird. I'm sure it was funny at times. But have they ever done like a JLI version of Doom Patrol?
Not quite, but Morrison, they did do several very funny issues, which basically made fun of them. There's the Mallar one, which is basically a mind versus body thing. And there's a bit where Cliff is actually in a stasis tank, not inside his metal body. And Mallar, you know, bursts in with the Brain and basically said, you two must fight, and throws the Brains together. So the Brains just bunk casings. So yeah, there's definitely humor in that. Even the Morrissey song, does the mind rule the body, or does the body rule the mind? I don't know, is part of that. And the other really funny Doom Patrol issues is the Beard Hunter one, which is a straight up parody of the Punisher. Except it's a guy's.
That's the only issue. That was the only issue of Doom Patrol I ever bought new from the Grant Morrison run.
Oh, right. The guy's lonely war on facial hair.
Yeah, and the big part I remember that is I think he's a big fan of what I believe was supposed to be Chris Claremont X-Men, and the whole thing comes down to, you know, he's not actually that good of a technical writer, and him having to come face-to-face with that at the end of the issue is just soul-crushing for this guy. It seemed like they were reading fandom for filth of that one.
Yeah, there's some real parodies of Alan Moore in there too, and also Frank Miller. Frank Miller gets a serve in that one.
I think I was probably too young to get the jokes. I should probably reread that issue sometime.
It's quite funny. But Superman's in space stopping missiles, so you know, some decent strain. I really like the way he draws Superman straining in these scenes.
I like that classical Superman face that he has. I'm also really enjoying all this Dark Flash. I like that costume. It didn't get a lot of play back in the day, and it seems to have been forgotten since then. And I know it's Grimdark, but I still think it looks cool.
Well, it was a mystery of who was the Flash this time, and we'd already had, you know, imposter Flashes, and this one turns, I think it's Walter West, who's an alternate version of Wally. Anyway, no one remembers the outcome of that. This was the tail end of Mark Waid and Al Guston's work on The Flash, where it really was running out of steam. So, you know, everyone loves The Flash, but I think The Flash by Waid, but what they love is the start of it, not the end of it, I'd say.
Right.
Yeah. And then we visit Sam Simeon, who is the ape from Angel and the Ape. I was a little disappointed we didn't get Angel in these scenes.
You know, this is another one where I'm familiar with them more from reference materials and from actual comics. I did read the Vertigo miniseries, I think Howard Chaykin did, also without Art Adams covers. And I think there was also one, was it Phil Foglio in the 90s that did one?
Yeah.
So I've got some exposure, but I just, those two never really clicked with me. I like the notion of it. I've always wanted to read Monkey Man and O'Brien too, to see how Arthur Adams played with that sort of dynamic, but they just never really came over for me. But I liked him fanboying over John Jones. And of course I would, but I like him being played as sort of a typical comic artist who's just like going to geek out on this stuff.
Well, the Ride On Network, they covered the Phil Foglio miniseries. So if you want to hear about that, you can listen to that one. That was part of this very month, JLA April. So then, yeah, JLA in action, running around rescuing people, saving things. And Ulgo is there in his monkey suit, his robot monkey mech. And the next stop on the tour by the Martian Manhunter is Congo Bill. Now, do you know much about Congo Bill? Is that a character that you've any familiarity with?
Not a ton of familiarity. I was always left with my head, scratching my head over the Steve Englehart miniseries from the 90s. It really felt like I was just starting to tiptoe back into DC Comics, and stuff like Kong really getting his own miniseries was like, is this really my place? Am I supposed to be in a reading comics from a company that's putting Kong Gorilla out in the early 90s when that's completely not welcome? And it's funny to me too, because again, there's another character that was just nothing prior to Who's Who and nothing for quite a while after Who's Who, but like Bobo, got a real bit of a renaissance in the 2000s, this time under James Robinson. And so I'm much more familiar with him now from his more modern take than I ever would be from the, you know, movie serial character, the classic comics. I don't think I've ever read a single one of those original stories. It's all been revivalist stuff like Secret Origins and such.
Yeah, I would be very reluctant to read the original stuff because I'm sure it's really on the nose as far as the white savior politics of it all were probably quite unpleasant. It'll be, you know, white guy in Africa solving all the problems, that's a genre, yeah, that's really out of favor now.
Certainly, yeah, we don't need another colonialist. No, we'll be good moving forward past this type of material. That's correct. But what is nice about this sequence is, and it's something they've been building throughout the issue, is you have all these apes of different walks of life, some heroes, some villains, some somewhere in between, but pretty consistently they're all like Grodd's, like they're Hannibal Lecter. Grodd's like the dude that just sets their hair on edge, and they just know something's wrong with this dude, and he scares them. And I love that they're making a point of selling Grodd. We know it's going to be Grodd at the end, so they're really just acting as hype men, but carry on. That's what I want. I want you to tell me how great Grodd is, because I'm a huge Grodd fan.
No, the gist of it all is, yeah, he's a bit too extreme to ally with and trust.
Well, and also it's cool too, because you see him exploiting his fellow gorillas. He'll talk a good game about gathering up followers and building up a resistance to the tyranny of Solovar and stuff, but ultimately it's clearly that it's all in for himself. And I do like that they position him as the intentional opposite of Solovar, somebody who could never be as good, so he was going to be as bad as possible in contrast. That suits that character very well. And also what I like is that because you're seeing how Gorilla Grodd relates to other apes in Gorilla City, they're focusing more on his character and not just him being the bad monkey guy that people are fighting. You know, it makes him a bad dude even within his own sphere.
Yeah, he is the gorilla's evil gorilla. Yeah. But the JLA wrapped up all the action. Basically, they've done all the rescuing. They've pulled the Kong ashore. They've stopped the nukes. And then Martian Manhunter hovers in the sky and said, "You're probably wondering why I called you all here." And so it's like we're going to get a Columbo reveal at this point.
Well, and I love that he even lampshades it. Call me whimsical if you must, but I've waited years for the appropriate time and place to say that. And it's basically him fanboying to his detective mystery stuff too. So yeah, I've done again. I love that everybody seems to be having a good time with this.
So basically, he names that the foe, the person behind, well, the gorilla behind all this is Gorilla Grodd. Oh my goodness.
Dun, dun, dun.
And the apes go apeshit when they hear this. But we see that Grodd is actually in the crowd. I didn't expect that. While all the other Greek apes are freaking out and saying outrageous, or it was obvious, he basically goes full evil in the midst of it all.
Well, and especially in our polarizing political times, to watch the gorillas fighting amongst themselves over whether or not they're pro or anti-Grodd is just, it's almost too on the nose. And it also really rubs our noses in how full of it we all are in these modern times, because clearly we are all still victims of our own tribalism.
Yeah. The gist of the plot was that by turning everybody into gorillas, he could tap into the gorilla minds and get super mindfulness. No, probably the wrong term.
Unimind or whatever, yeah.
Yeah, he would ascend into, you know, ultimate mental power. Yeah, and he attacks Martian Manhunter with his force of mind in a fantastic splash page, which has the Martian Manhunter reeling back and turning from his traditional superhero form into his Martian form. Yeah, that's a great
one thing
page.
I love about this, I love it in the annual, and they play with it a little bit in this time period, because when they were retconning Martian Manhunter into stories that he really wasn't a part of, since, you know, he's the longest serving, most fidelitous member of the Justice League, when you don't count the 20 some odd years he wasn't on the team from 68 to 84 or whatever. But they were retconning that, and so they kept sticking him into these stories, and because he's a telepath, it just made sense. Well, Grodd's one of the major Silver Age characters. At some point, you'd pit them against one another. Naturally, he's obviously best known as a Flash villain, but even visually, they're trying to sell it here, because both of the characters have a cape. They're both rocking the high vampire collars. Marshmander's got the blue cape. Grodd's got the purple cape. The cape also helps to set Grodd against all the other gorillas. It makes him look super amongst a whole nation of gorillas. Plus, he's got the longish hair, like the Carmine Infantino hair. So even though he is more or less the same design as the other characters, his nudity, his nakedness as an ape, he's not running around in human clothing aside from the cape, but he's also got the long hair and distinctive features to let you know, he's set apart from the other gorillas, and he's more fantastical. And again, by rocking that cape, it really shows like the mental and physical contest between these two characters.
Yeah, I get real Christopher Lee vibes from Grodd in this. Yeah, but it's probably because I've been watching too much Hammer horror. But the high collar cape and the stature and the regal bearing of him all. But Martian Manhunter turns the tables on him in a very interesting way. So basically, he starts to worship him, and with awe and humility, I salute you, because you have the guts to let your mind ascend and lose all your ego and become enlightened.
It's the whole quasi-Buddhism thing that DeMatteis brought into the character in the late 80s, and just going for it there. So I thought that was clever.
Yeah, I mean, this is a ploy that, I mean, basically all his interviews with colleagues have shed the light on the fact that Grodd has a massive ego, very self-centered, and, you know, the threat of losing his identity in an ascendancy is too much for him, and he backs away from it. And he rejects the power, and he goes from, you know, ranting to collapsing on the ground.
Yeah, and another one of this is too, where it's going to be difficult. This is still the era of the Morrison, Porter, JLA. They're actually still doing the book. They're on their last big arc, World War III. That's a lot to compete with. And obviously, there's been a lot of talk about how few people were up to the challenge of trying to work alongside or succeed that combo. It was such a creative powerhouse and such a iconic moment for that team and for comics in general. And I think that they recognize that, look, I'm Lynn Kaminsky, you're Gus Vasquez. We're not going to be able to compete with these guys on a level playing field. But if we have an annual and we can do like three consecutive two-page splashes in a row, that will give us that widescreen Brian Hitch, Warren Ellis quote to our monkey story. And I dig that. And again, I appreciate it as an older reader who's already reading way too many books for things like podcasts and blogging, that it gave me a little bit of a breather as well. So it was a nice visual. And also, I didn't have to read, you know, eight more pages of nine panel grids or something.
And the three pages have the continuing theme of the multiple versions of one character either receding or growing. So, yeah, interesting.
Well, and this was, again, a very particular time I was extremely invested in Martian Manhunter because I was extremely invested in JLA, and because I had finally come to recognize how much I love the character just a few years prior to this. I was still working on my old web TV blogging system then, so I was doing my best to represent in the pioneering days of the internet, and I took artwork for that blog. And also I really appreciate it because so much of the artwork floating around at that time to be contemporaneous to JLA, they took heavily from the Secret Files and Origins, the first one of those they put out, which had art by Don Hillsman III. And Hillsman's rendition of Manhunter seemed to strike a chord with people. It's a shame they didn't do more with that. And Vasquez's style is similar enough to Hillsman's to where it feels like a continuation, and it feels like this is how his book is supposed to look as one of the JLA members, just the way that Daryl Banks was the way that Kyle Rayner was supposed to look, and so on and so forth. And Vasquez is particularly good at drawing the natural form Martian, where he's obviously got that Mark Badger weird Gumby thing going on, but he also kind of hones it in and makes it a little bit more, you know, crunchy alien kind of thing. And so he makes it look cool where often it doesn't look quite so much cool. And I remember specifically sitting there in early MS Paint, you know, cropping out that one of the images from these spreads of the National Forest Martian Manhunter for web TV. So a lot of nostalgia berries, memory berries in this book for me.
There's really not much more to this story apart from, you know, Green Lantern flies up into space and builds a construct which allows them to do the morphic resonation to reverse all the gorillaness around the planet. And then the JLA are patting themselves on the back, and Grodd's off to the asylum, where he does an evil grin to let you know that it's never over with him.
Yeah, I'm always going to have hesitation with killing off a character that was as long-lived as Solovar and somebody who's so closely associated with a core concept of the Flash mythos. But what I do like is that despite positioning Olgo as a villainous presence, as as an aggressor early on in the story, I like that that character has a redemption arc. And he's not just part of the conspiracy, part of the cabal. He's thinking for himself. And to some degree, he's a guy who should be positioned to be the successor to Solovar with him dead. Now, tell me this, though, as a person who's much more invested in modern DC Comics than I am, as somebody who really started to drift away after Infinite Crisis, have that in common with Michael Bailey, did they bring back Solovar? Or did, because I know Olgo and none of these characters really got a lot of play after the event, but did Solovar stay dead or did they bring him back ultimately?
Yeah, no, Solovar comes back, and it's one of those, oh, he was always there. It's never explained how he came back from the dead. So, yeah, he basically just resumes his normal role in the gorilla hierarchy of Gorilla City. Mm. So, to me, it's an odd change. Like, there's no reason, really, to bring him back apart from name recognition. I mean, it's not like, you know, there's a great Solovar characterization that carries on, but I guess people just like to, you know, play with the original toys.
Well, and I think, too, that you're not going to have a group of fans gather money together to buy ads in Wizard Magazine to denounce the death of Solovar. You can actually have a permanent change, theoretically. And it is a good way of trying to launch these characters if you want to expand upon Gorilla City and be able to come back to these characters. But again, one of the problems that I have with a lot of modern creators is the lack of a monoculture. It used to be that all the people read all the comics that were on the stands, and so when you'd bring back some obscure character, people would respond to that. But now there's so many books, so many universes, that you have a bunch of people get together to try to invest in creating a whole rogues gallery of villains for Gorilla City, and then whenever you come back to Gorilla City in the years coming forward, they just completely forget these characters ever happened. I appreciate the effort to expand upon Gorilla City, give it more citizens, give you more suspects if you ever want to do something like this again, so there's not just Grodd. But given that that thing came out of these characters, ultimately we're back to just Grodd and apparently just Solovar as well.
Yeah, it's funny. Gorilla Grodd is a well that everyone keeps going back to, and you know, Geoff Johns played with the idea of, you know, wow, gorillas are really tough and strong, and let's, you know, see him being a gorilla and how terrifying that is. But at the end of the day, he's a gorilla who talks. I mean, you know, there's not so much you can do with that unless you're doing grim and gritty nonstop. So, yeah.
And for me, my introduction to Grodd would have likely been Challenge of the Super Friends. And him in that context works really well. When you're going so fantastical that you've got something like a Legion of Doom, yeah, go for it. But yeah, when you're trying to do that sort of edgy, grimdark stuff like Geoff Johns did, you could Grodd can play in those fields. You know, he's capable. He can go to those places, but there is almost an inherent self-parody in that. You could be, and they even point out in this book how this image of what gorillas are versus the reality. It's almost like anti-ape propaganda when you go that route. So I don't necessarily favor that.
I mean, no one wants to be trapped in a cage with a real gorilla, but we sure like to read adventures about them. So,
and I do really like the closing too, because you could have just wrapped it up, but I love how they have that whole page of Marshmallow monologuing just to lean into that. I will remain an outsider on the planet of the apes. I love how hard he just goes the whole road to get to the punchline of the entire event. I appreciate that. And it suits Marshmallow to have that particular monologue. So yeah, I'm definitely game for that.
So, I mean, as an annual, this really did your boy right. Well, that's
yeah,
great.
This is what I wanted. This is why, like you've mentioned in the past that you and I might have had run-ins on the DC Comics message boards, possibly threats of violence coming from me to you for no particular good reason. I'm not sure. I was a rowdy boy back then, and I wasn't as familiar with propriety. Plus, I think that we all understood hyperbole back then in a way that's been lost in the years since. But yeah, I was definitely a part of a small but rabid group of anti-Ostrander series people on that board, and you were one of the proponents of that series. And I will say that with years to look back on that, I still would have much rather had a Lynn Kaminsky, Gus Vasquez series that would have better reflected what I wanted from a Martian Manhunter series than what I ended up getting.
Yeah, my recollection, it was a Martian Manhunter party, and you were there pissing in the punch the whole time.
Yeah, that sounds about right. Me, Tex Cap, and who's the other fella who was always up in there? Anyway, yeah, we were the bad boys. It's true. And I'm sorry. And yet I'm not sorry, because that series still makes me mad 30 years later.
Ah, oh, we've moved on. We've moved on. Yeah.
You've moved on. I've still got the blog.
Well, the good news is you've had so many great Martian Manhunter runs since then, so it's washed the taste away.
Touche. Yeah, just go ahead and pour the whole container of salt into the wound, why don't you?
Well, that ends our coverage of JL April. So, Frank, tell people about your podcast and what you've got going on.
One of the reasons why I didn't contribute my own podcast and was happy to latch onto yours is I've just been doing 4 podcasts for the most part this whole year, and they've all been pretty intensive. So I just don't have a lot of time for anything else right now. But also, I've had a Martian Manhunter podcast for most of the length of time I've been podcasting. And really, with the exception of JL May when it comes around, I just am not very good about keeping that up. But the blog is still there, and I'm actually trying to keep getting a weekly post out more or less, building up to next year when we'll have the, I think it's the 60th anniversary we're coming up to now. And so I'm planning on kind of pulling out all the stops. I've got a bunch of artwork that I commissioned years ago that's not been seen by the general public that I want to try to get out there and try to cover more stuff like this that I actually enjoy instead of the usual, you know, pissing in the punch bowl that I may be known for. But in the meantime, I'm working on my comic reader resume podcast, which I finally have a promo for. Basically because I needed to throw something together the last minute. I've got the Terminator Now, where I'm covering Terminator in comic books. I'm still doing the Aliens podcast monthly for this year, covering the Dark Horse comics. And we do the Marvel Superheroes as well, which is our flagship. It's the one we've been doing all these years. And that's the one where we have potty mouths, like Paul would occasionally lean into on this episode. And I was trying my best to be a good boy. And then he'll say shit every now and again. It's like, well, there goes our family-friendly, non-explicit tag.
Yeah, I'm Aussie, so it's, you know, it just happens.
It's just the default state.
Yeah. And your Terminator coverage, of course.
Oh, yeah, and that's of particular interest to folks listening to this podcast, because our own Flanger will be a part of that in the relatively near future. He joins me for several episodes, some key Terminator material, good stuff that we were happy to talk about. So you have that to look forward to starting in, I believe, July is when your first episode drops.
Coming up fast, yeah. Otherwise, from me, we'll be still doing some more DC OCD, so I think we're coming up with a run of small ones. I think we're going to do the Shadow War, which is an event that hardly anyone has heard of. And then there's the War for Earth 3, which is another one that hardly anyone's heard. But past that, we get to Flashpoint Beyond, and we'll close out the season with Dark Crisis. So there's some meaty
Have
stuff
you ever
coming.
Considered just like circling back and catching a few that you missed that maybe you felt like you would have enjoyed? Because you're so far, you're like my ambassadors. Like, I'm so divorced from DC now that literally a lot of stuff you guys are talking about, you are the only source I have for this information.
Janus Directive haunts me, but you know, I wish I'd covered it back in the day. But I just really, really like that story. But I know it's not very eventy, and I know it has no legacy. So I'm kind of loath to put it on the rankings.
As opposed to like Batman versus Robin and stuff, it really doesn't rate.
Yeah. Anyway, I mean, if I do these slow enough, I don't have to take a break. So, but we'll see. So I'm trying to do one every 2 months. So Shadow War will be coming out in May.
What about Dark Crisis, though?
Okay. We'll get to Dark Crisis at the end of the year, man.
The season finale. Gotcha.
Yeah. All right. So that's all for this one. So thanks for listening.
And thanks for having me. Like I said, I appreciate having the chance to talk to Martian Manhunter without actually doing the work myself. I'm Diablo Frank, and on Comic Reader Resume, I use Mike's Amazing World of Comics to travel back through time via his virtual newsstand. From there, I offer a work history of my fandom through my active purchasing of relatively new comic books beginning in January of 1982. Starting around the mid-80s, I also begin to cover television, movies, music, books, magazines, video games, history. It's basically my biography, the clean version, in podcast form, available on the 4-Color Rolled Spine feed.